So, my name is Robin Geuze. I used to work for TransIP at first and Team Blue after they merged with a bunch of other companies for about a decade until a month ago. During that time period, we transitioned from running our own closed source DNS server software to running open source DNS server software. And just like the talk we just had, that happens to be PowerDNS. So I'll take you through the issues we had going from closed source to open source, which roughly took the entire time I was there, about 9 years. Let's start. So how it started for me, TransDNS, which they called the homebrew DNS software, was written originally in about 2003-2004. And it had DNSSEC support added in 2012. When I started working at TransIP in 2013 as a PHP coder, I was asked to help them debug a crasher in the TransDNS code. It basically came down to a buffer overflow because somebody had, one of our customers had managed to put more than 16 kilobytes of text record data on one single label. The really ugly quick fix was to increase the buffer to 32 kilobytes. And one small disclaimer, I was involved in almost all of the work that I mentioned here, but there are some things that I didn't do myself or just consulted on, stuff like that. I'll try to make a distinction about it, but I might miss some stuff. So back then it was a really basic setup. We basically had three servers. They were all running TransDNS. There was no load balancing. The signing stack was built using DNSSEC tools for those few people who still know what it is. And there was a lot of automation on top of DNSSEC tools in PHP to make all of that work and automatically upload stuff to the registries because we were a registrar, so a lot of the stuff was automated. All of this DNS propagation was done to cron jobs, which means it was very slow. It took roughly 5 minutes to propagate a DNS change, which back then wasn't really a big problem, but as we went on, it became more and more an issue, especially when we got Let's Encrypt and you needed to quickly update your DNS to get your certificate signed. We had at the high, I think we still have roughly 1 million zones in the setup. Most of which, so about 80-90%, are DNSSEC signed. There were very few people back then that actually knew stuff about it and dared to work on it. I think maybe 3 or 4 people, one of which was I. It had very bad RFC compatibility, which I will get into a little bit later. And adding new record types, which Kevin mentioned, like SSH-FP, was a lot of work because there was a interpreter in TransDNS itself, which had to be written in C, and writing interpreters in C for stack strings is not fun. I fixed that initial buffer overflow block, but the main problem was there was just not a lot of bound checking in the code. So yeah, there were a lot of hidden bugs that probably should be fixed as well. So we took a few initial steps because we had the three servers, there was no load balancing in front of that. It meant that if we restarted TransDNS, one of the servers would stop responding until the restart was done. And the restart took roughly 15 minutes because every single record would get loaded into memory. And since we had a million zones, I think it was like 25 million records or something back then, it just took a lot of time. Might have used the quick DNS zone parser stuff, but you know. So the first thing we did was implement load balancing. This was before DNS disk was a thing. So what we tried initially was Relay Day, which some of the BSD folks might know. It did work, but we had a lot of weird issues. It was really hard to debug. So eventually we switched to using HAProxy for TCP, which works, nothing more to say about it. And I wrote something rather quickly in C, roughly based on the TransDNS code, to forward the UDP stuff. That worked quite well and actually enabled us to actually iterate on the TransDNS code because we could do safe restarts without having to worry about queries being dropped. And that allowed me to fix the glaring issues like there not being any bounce checking in the code, so we had less risk of buffer overflows. And I fixed a lot of the EDNS comp issues that were becoming a problem at that point. Eventually, when DNS disk was a little bit more mature, we switched to that. because otherwise I had to maintain another piece of software, and I really didn't feel like that. In the meantime, I did improve the TCP stack a lot in TransDNS, because we noticed that especially SIDN, the .NL registry, did a lot of TCP queries, and that's the original implementation was basically just spawn a new thread for every TCP connection. But once you get to about 1,000 threads, that's not really all that. Well, it's not a great solution. So I changed to a polling-based model. Worked great, got pretty high performance, and we never had a problem with it after that. The only thing I changed later is when we moved to Linux, I changed it to EPOL. So SIDN had validation monitoring, and we kept getting reminded about the fact that we were doing a lot of stuff wrong. We actually had one specific case that basically covered most of the, I think it was about 80% of those errors. It's actually two issues, but they have the same cause. So the first issue was the incorrect handling of wildcards. So if you have a wildcard that, for example, star.nl, and you have a record c.nl, and then you try to resolve a.c.nl, it should not hit the wildcard, because c.nl exists, which means you should return a no data, or an extra main in this case. But TransDNS didn't really care, so it would just return the data from the wildcard. Very useful, it makes it a lot easier to configure DNS, but it causes some issues, especially with DNSSEC validation. The second issue was basically the same, only the empty non-terminals. If a.b.c exists, and you try to resolve b.c, even though there's nothing specific on b.c, you should say there's no data rather than it's a non-existent domain. Also causes DNSSEC validation errors. Same basic cause. The solution was to switch from, in TransDNS, to switch from an ordered map that used the type and the domain name as the key to a map that only used the domain name as the key, and have an array in there with the types, which could also be empty. So we would immediately notice if there was a label in our way. That worked well. I actually did it. This is the next slide. So the only problem is we couldn't just deploy that, because we might break stuff for our customers, and customers get a little bit difficult if you break stuff for them. So what I decided was, okay, for DNSSEC it's broken anyways, because DNSSEC enables resolvers would just return errors when you have one of these labels. What I did is fix it in two steps. I initially enabled it only for DNSSEC queries, so the correct behavior, and kept the wrong behavior for non-DNSSEC queries. And in between, we just captured a large amount of queries. I think I did 2 days of TCP dumping and milling it down to the actual unique queries, and compared what our name servers would respond for DNSSEC versus non-DNSSEC. For everything that had a difference, we contacted the customers and told them, hey, you need to fix this. I think it was only about 20 to 30 customers. It was actually not that many, so that made it a lot easier. And then we just, at some point I decided I'll flip the switch. There were a few customers that didn't respond, but you know, at some point you just have to decide to, don't give a fuck. One other small issue we had with RFC implementation was the NSSEC implementation, because almost all of our zones use NSSEC 3. The NSSEC implementation was not as well tested as the NSSEC 3 implementation, so it was wrong, like really wrong. I just rewrote it from scratch and then it worked, but yeah. So we started to think about moving to PowerDNS, and the main reason we did was because SIDN announced that we would no longer get a DNSSEC incentive for domains using DNS key algorithm 7. So that's the RSA plus NSSEC 3 algorithm. That would cost us a bunch of money, and that's a very good way to stimulate people to do stuff. So at this point, we decided to bite the bullet and just start over from scratch and build a really new, more modern setup. We picked PowerDNS, partially because we already had some experience with it, And we didn't really want to deal with zone files because we had a million zones, and putting them all on a file system makes things annoying. So PowerDNS was the only one where we thought, oh, this allows us to do changes via the API. We don't need to worry about having separate zone files for every single zone. So we needed to pick a PowerDNS backend to use, because PowerDNS is one thing, but you still need something to put stuff in. And there we sort of hit a problem, because TransDNS is really fast, because it's literally just a hash map in memory. So it can basically do instant answers. And well, the PowerDNS SQL backend is very nice and flexible, but it's not really fast, especially not because we had a lot of zones that would not get very frequent queries. So they'd have a lot of non-active data, which means the query cache wouldn't really help a lot, which means that we would have a lot of SQL queries continuously, because they would get queried sometimes, just not a lot. The Wine backend had the same problem as all the other name servers. We didn't have API support, and it would mean we needed to use a lot of zone files, which we didn't want to. So introducing the LMDB backend. This already existed at the point that we started looking at it, because Hubert had written it. It's very fast, and it has support for the API, which is really nice. It only had one major issue. Because of the way Bert had implemented it, it didn't really allow records bigger than 512 bytes. We have quite a lot of those. So I decided to fix that in the end. I wrote a pull request for the PowerDNS team, and I think that was pretty quickly accepted into there. It also included some migration code, so the LDMB database would be automatically migrated to the new LDMB database format. It also improved performance in some corner cases, but that was not really the goal of this patch. So then we started moving over. Well, we built a setup. It was really cool. There's a lot of automation around it. It does actually do all the zone transfers via AXFR, even though Kevin just said it's a bad idea if you have a lot of zones. But in practice, it works quite well, except for one issue. Every Thursday, our updates would take ages to go through. And we traced it down to an enormous bump in the AXFR queues. Like, we would literally have 400,000 AXFR queued up. So that was a bit of a problem. So the reason this happens is because PowerDNS renews its signatures every first day of the week. Very nice. We don't have to think about it. Problem is, if you have a million zones, that takes quite a while, especially because we were running our hidden primary on a VM, so it was also not that quick to answer queries. So we could have just thrown more hardware at it, but we decided to look a little bit more at a more sustainable solution, because, well, if it works with 1 million zones on a faster machine, will it will still work if you have 10 million zones? So I discussed it with the PowerDNS guys, and I came up with a solution which is AXFR priority levels. So rather than treating all AXFRs that need to be done at the same level, we gave more priority to things that are user-initiated. So if you initiate a AXFR via PowerDNS control, it will be first in the queue. Whatever else is in the queue, that one will get treated first. After that, there's the API, notifies, server refresh, and signature refresh is the lowest priority. That meant that, yes, we would still have quite a large queue, but we could still process our updates very quickly. That was included into PowerDNS quite quickly as well. In 4.5, it was included. We still saw the use queues, but the zone updates would pretty quickly propagate. So that, for us, was fine. We never had a problem with it after that. Yeah, and then we had some other issues, most of which were either minor, solved in the load balancer layer, or just fixed in PowerDNS updates. The TCP performance is still something I want to look at in PowerDNS, just for fun, as a open source developer. It's on my list of things I want to improve. We had some various smaller bugs in the LMDB backend because it was quite new. We were not the first one that ran it at really large scale, but we were one of the first ones, and we did see some problems that nobody else had yet. One CVE we discovered literally within a day of rolling out a new version. So that was very fun for Peter because he got to roll out a new release a day after he released the previous one. And we had the issue that there were certain query patterns that we would get that were specifically designed to target a weakness in PowerDNS. TransDNS really didn't care about them, but PowerDNS did get affected. We eventually resolved this by adding some detection at the load balancer layer that would just block queries for those affected domains. It would mean that customer's domain would have limited functionality, but at least it would still work, and all the other customers would not be affected, which was for us the most important thing. Yeah, so some closing thoughts. Migrating a homebrew setup is really not for the faint of heart. However, running one is also not for the faint of heart. So, it is worth it. It just gives you a lot more flexibility because now adding new record types is just a question of adding them in our front end and making them work. Whereas before we had to add the new record type at every single step in the stack, and it just really took a lot of time. We can even in theory add different brands of secondaries. Currently, there's a few issues that would prevent it, but it's relatively easy to solve. So we could just run NOT as a secondary or NSD or even bind if we would want to do that for some reason. What I did really, really notice is don't try to do this in one go because it's a lot of work and you'll make mistakes. If you do it in smaller steps, the mistakes will be smaller, easier to fix, and it also just feels a lot better if you can accomplish some things in between rather than trying to do it all at once. And one thing I wanted to ask, DNSSEC incentives, they work both when trying to get people to use DNSSEC, but they also work to improve the quality of that DNSSEC, because we've seen, especially in the .NL zone, because I've also been involved in that work a little bit, some very bad implementations that got fixed when the rules were made stricter, including ours initially, but we were even the worst ones. That is it. For the people that would like to see, I've open sourced TransDNS before I left the company, so I can see it myself as well still, so that's fun. It's on GitHub. I've also put the URLs for the two major pull requests I made. There's a bunch of other ones, but I haven't put all of them in there. And that's about it. So, questions? So the comment is, we both made mistakes. Like it was a bit related to the tell Kevin did. So a lot of the things that are that we said are related. And the comment is, Kevin was only doing it for himself, and we were doing it for paying customers. I agree. When I started, there were a lot of issues, and I've tried 3 years to attempt to fix them as much as I could. To be clear, I wasn't hired to maintain TransDNS. That just happened to be something that got shoved into my lab because I knew some C and C++. I became pretty passionate about it. I came pretty quickly rolled into the PowerDNS community. I also added a lot of contributions to DNSDisk when that was getting started up. I agree with the initial statement, and yeah. I've tried to fix it as much as I could.
I don't make a comment to his comment. Sometimes you set out with certain criteria, okay, and you build something that you meet that criteria, and it scales to a certain point, and eventually you get to 100 million customers, and a lot of customers. I'm sure the company didn't start off with a million customers, and maybe at the time that this was a good system, people thought they needed to leave. But as the business grew and things grow, sometimes you have to do exactly what he did, reevaluate and say, it's time for something different. It's good that he identified that and made the changes accordingly and great solution.
So brief resume. He said that sometimes you, due to scaling, you run into issues that you hadn't foreseen when you were an engineer set something up. And just taking the step to resolve them in the end can be a good thing. I think there was a question there.
How did you get your employer to agree with open sourcing their own products?
So the question is, how did I get them to agree with open sourcing it? At the point that I open sourced it, I was sort of CTO / head of R&D of the Dutch part of the organization. I only open sourced it after we totally took it out of production. So it's mainly a historic interest thing.
Did you ever consider open sourcing TransDNS before switching?
The question is, did we consider open sourcing it before switching? No. And I'll tell you, we weren't very proud of, at least I wasn't proud of the source code quality. I didn't write it myself, all of it. I only contributed to it later. I tried to improve it as much as I could, but it's still not. It's very focused on just doing one thing, and it's very good at that, but it's not very applicable to use by others. So I think it's interesting now to see some of the tricks to make things really fast that you can see in the code. But beyond that, I would never use it in a production environment other than the one it was in, because that one was built specifically to run around that code. Yeah, so the question is, what was the motivation to implement their own DNS software? Yeah, so to be clear, so TransDNS was implemented in 2003. So this was